Okay! Tokyo!
South America!
Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Well, hot diggity, everything appears to work tonight, so maybe we'll, that part of the of last night's little snafu is taken care of. Here it is, the 21st day of December. I'm here. Are you here? Are we here? We're here. Unless, of course, Hinduism is right and this is all an illusion. You know, it's really not fair telling people that, is it? This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Available to you in a wide variety of platforms when you're away from your computer. When you're at your computer, it's easiest just to go to headonradionetwork.com and click Listen Live. But when you are out and about and on your mobile devices, your smartphones and such like, tablets and what have you, you can use interfaces like the TuneIn Radio app or the Stitcher app. Other websites can also support the Horn's broadcast. Things like Dar.fm, Streama.com, Roku.com, Roku devices. Goodness me, there's just a bunch of them. It is the 21st of December. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. There, we've gotten that out of the way now. And we've made it through a week of broadcasting. And this is, I guess we would call it Christmas weekend. A lot of people will be making a long weekend out of things since Christmas falls on Tuesday. We will have a Christmas Eve show. So that's Monday night. We'll try to keep up with some old, well, not old, but we'll keep up with some traditions that we have established over the years. Having the young'uns read the Christmas story out of the Gospels. The Christmas myth. I mean, it's what it is. It's a myth. Hagiography, another fun word for that. And I don't know, Ferg may plug his guitar up to the mix desk here. He has become ever more competent in what in his... musical performance. So that's Monday evening. For now, though, I guess we wrap up the week, don't we? And, of course, this being Friday, it is, in fact, Friday on the front porch. That means that, well, anything goes. Anything always goes. I mean, who am I trying to kid? But this is Friday on the front porch, and we did lane over, not been talked about. Everything is on the table, so to speak, this evening. And I encourage you, especially if you have not participated in the conversation all week long, to do so. I'm just now firing up Skype. And that's another a means of reaching the program. The handle here, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. If you've not made a contact request in the past and you'd like to get on the program that way, well, just feel free to send one through, and I'll accept your request, and we'll go forward with that. Let's see. Okay, added you. And, yeah. Tar Heel South. Cool. Added you. All right. Good deal. So that part of the business is taken care of. A gentle reminder, We try to raise $150 a night to keep things going here. And this night is no different. That's 15 people at $10 a piece, 10 at 15 a piece, 2 at 75, 3 at 50, 6 at 25, and we know how I do with math on the fly. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the snail mail address, if you prefer to go that direction. That is under the tab Contribute, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, West Virginia, 25801. Yes, you did, Cassie. Thank you very much. Our own Cassie is in the chat room this evening. Home on break from her junior year at Princeton. And making all of her Horn family very, very, very proud. Ferg's doing okay, Cassie. She said, how's Ferg? I used to talk to him when I called Agnes. Yeah, Ferg's doing okay. He really is becoming quite the self-taught musician. And trying to focus a little bit more on his studies. And, well, dadgummit, they're just growing up is what they're doing. Indeed. You think about that kind of thing at Christmas season, especially for Ferg, because, well, Ferg has never gotten a fair shake on his birthday because his birthday's the day after Christmas. His mother and I probably should have thought that through, but, yeah, day after Christmas. Or as a dear friend of mine from the UK used to say, he's my Boxing Day baby. I think Boxing Day is a nice holiday. We should adopt it here. So, where do we go tonight? Well, update, I suppose. Really? Okay, let me check that. Really, Randy? We have been re-added to iTunes Radio? I'm not talking about the podcast. Are we on iTunes Radio again? Did somebody finally catch up with that? That would be nice. A little housekeeping, I guess. You know, of course, that the NRA had its double-secret probation press conference today. And not that I'm any kind of prophet, because this didn't take any real brains, especially since Senator Joe Manchin, of the junior senator of West Virginia, had given away pretty much the plan. He telegraphed the whole thing. You remember early in the week when everybody, oh, look, a pro-gun senator is saying we need common sense. And then by the next day, he'd said, no, I didn't say that at all. And then we got the senior senator from West Virginia pontificating about movies and violent video games, and you just kind of knew it was going to go downhill from there, didn't you? I did. So, no, the NRA had its press conference today. Wayne LaPierre rubbed the blood off of his hands long enough to... I'm surprised he didn't leave little bloody handprints on the podium. But, you know, they gave us a lecture on... I don't know, what we need to do to make them happy. At this point in time, this entire nation is in a hostage situation that is occasioned by the National Rifle Association. Do what we say or the country gets it. That's basically the thrust of the National Rifle Association's position. But it was as though Wayne LaPierre had taken the brown acid and with monsters breathing out of the wall and the sky gone paisley, he stepped up to the podium and just opened his mouth and let his crazy flag fly. His psychopathic flag fly. Let's see, what do we got here? They want among other things. No, really, this is the takeaway of the National Rifle Association to the horror in Newtown, Connecticut. The takeaway for the NRA, if you can believe it, is that we need more guns in schools. Really. You know, Wayne LaPierre and his psychopathic or sociopathic pals over at the National Rifle Association are the reason that I keep a bottle of rot gut tequila on hand, because sometimes when that stuff starts, that's your only hope is to upend that bottle of Mexican gasoline and hope somehow or another it helps him to start making sense, because there's nothing sensible. Really? More guns in schools? That's the answer. We need to kill every insane killer in America. Notice how they put insane in there. This is, the NRA is going to hammer away on the mentally ill now so that the gun goobs can keep collecting Bushmasters. Walmart has run out of Bushmasters in at least five states so far, Alabamistan being, of course, one of them. The NRA wants to tell every insane killer in America that schools are their safest place to inflict maximum mayhem with minimum risk until we get more guns in them. That's it, yeah. Having a gun-free school. They hate gun-free school zones because, you know, that's what toddlers need to see. Guns, every, you know, kindergartners, head starters. That's what they need to see. People wandering around an armed camp. They need to grow up, because that's how you make fascism take hold. You get to the minds of the little ones first. And so in the mind of the NRA, a gun-free school zone is an invitation to, in their words, inflict maximum mayhem with minimum risk. Another quote from LaPierre in between the moments when he wasn't seeing the giant ogres or whatever. There exists in this country a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and sows violence against its own people. Well, yeah. It's the NRA. But that wasn't what he was talking about. Suddenly the NRA is, as I predicted, concerned about a host of social ills. It would not have surprised me to have seen them come out and acknowledge climate change, anything to keep us from looking at them. Honest to God. Asking the NRA to opine about our gun violence problem in America is like asking zombies to tell us how to protect our brains. It's like asking Dracula whether or not we should keep garlic. Right? Violent crime. Wait a minute. Granted, he's dead, but it works so much better in his voice. Violent crime is increasing again for the first time in 19 years. Add another hurricane, terrorist attack, or some other natural or man-made disaster, mister, and you've got a recipe for a national nightmare of violence and victimization. Huh. Nothing in there about adding a few million Bushmasters, is there? Well, no, there's not. We need to have every single school in America immediately deploy a protection program proven to work. And by that, I mean armed security. Or some hotshot's gonna flame your ass. Okay, I added the last part. That's from Charlton Heston's movie speeches in the movie Midway. You better watch it, mister, or some hotshot Jap pilot's gonna flame your ass. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Would you rather have your 911 call bring a good guy with a gun from a mile away or a minute away? And, like I said, they are terribly, terribly concerned about our social ills. You know, all of our social ills, except for the firearm-based social ill. Throughout it all, too many in our national media, their corporate owners and their stockholders, act as silent enablers, if not complicit co-conspirators. You know, it takes a lot of nerve for the NRA to use the phrase co-conspirator, complicit co-conspirator. But nerve they've got aplenty, and gall they have by the gallon. The NRA is the single greatest complicit co-conspirator to the horrors that transpire on any random day in this country. My God Almighty, I've got a story right here. Today, from today, from Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania, Alabama. There's no let up. Dateline, December 21st, 2012, Blair County, Pennsylvania, via KDKA Pittsburgh. Tim from L.A. sent this along. Emergency officials are on the scene of a deadly shooting in Frankstown Township in Blair County, PA. Right now, sources tell KDKA-TV that four people are dead. Well, if we the cutoff is five for mass murder. So we won't be calling this, a mass murder. Four people are dead. Three Pennsylvania state troopers were also hurt and are expected to be okay. At least part of the shooting took place at the Juniata Valley Gospel Church. Troopers responded to a 911 shots fired call about 9 a.m. this morning. Additional 911 calls reported an armed man shooting at additional locations. Two troopers were fired at by the driver of a pickup truck on Juniata Valley Road, and a third officer was injured in a head-on crash with the pickup. Sources say the suspect was Jeffrey Lee Michael of Hollidaysburg, PA. He exited the truck and immediately shot at troopers. Troopers returned fire, killing Jeffrey Lee Michael. Body armor saved one of the troopers. No word, according to KDKA, on the three people Mr. Michaels allegedly killed before firing at the troopers. Really. And so with that, this from today's NRA press conference. Then there's the blood-soaked slasher films like American Psycho and Natural Born Killers that are aired like propaganda loops on splatter days and every day, and 1,000 music videos that portray life as a joke and murder as a way of life. Well, all I can say to you, Wayne LaPierre, is you can have my violent videos when you pry them from my cold, dead fingers. Nah, I don't like that. In a race to the bottom, media conglomerates compete with one another to shock, violate, and offend every standard of civilized society by bringing an ever more toxic mix of reckless behavior and criminal cruelty into our homes. Every minute of every day, of every month, of every year, even when they're showing Rudolph, Mr. LaPierre. Um, Rick Goodner, horn psychotherapist, you wouldn't happen to be out there this evening, would you, my friend? Because if you are, we need a little help. Because this is everything I've read here transference? Are they unwittingly... Why, yes, Bob, as a matter of fact, they are. They are unwittingly, Freudianly, I might add. Not that I'm a self-promoter or anything. No, of course not, Doc. Yes, they are describing themselves to a T. And everybody in the world knows it but them. That is the problem with sociopaths. They think the rest of us are crazy. Thank you, Doc. How's the cigar? Oh, very, very good, Herb. Very good. It is, of course, only a cigar. We understand, Doc. Through vicious, violent video games with names like Bulletstorm, Grand Theft Auto, Mortal Kombat, and Splatterhouse. And here's one. It's called Kindergarten Killers. It's been online for 10 years. How come my research department could find it and all of yours either couldn't or didn't want anyone to know you had found it? Gee, I don't know, Wayne. I mean, how come everybody with a half of a functioning human brain understands that you're a psychopathic monster who ought to be wearing a goddamn Hannibal Lecter mask and behind one of those glass walls with the holes in it where you can get air, but you don't recognize it yourself? I mean, these questions work both ways. Isn't fantasizing about killing people as a way to get your kicks really the filthiest form of pornography? Well, yes, Wayne, it is, and that happens every time a bunch of your members go to the damn shooting range. In fact, many of the paper targets at which they shoot at said range are in the silhouette of a human being. Ha 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 ha, you thought we'd forgotten about that, didn't you, Wayne? Jesus Christ. So is it clear? Are we all? Sort of inured, settled in to this reality? Do we understand that instead of trying to help prevent the next Newtown, the NRA is going to continue to try to facilitate it? They're not going to stand idly by. If we, the people, in our ongoing effort to form a more perfect union, come up with something rational that deals with these things, like criminalizing the possession of multi-round magazines, about which we got crickets from the NRA, or proposing a buyback of these monster militarized weapons for civilian use. Again, crickets from the NRA. Or after the buyback, deeply criminalizing the possession of said weapons. Well, that wouldn't get crickets. That would get an absolute poop storm of outraged howls from the lizard brain bunch. If, in fact, we get to the point where we can ban the future sale of these damned things, the NRA has made it clear that they are going to side with those who want more kindergartners stitched in two by NATO standard military rounds. Jim puts it very succinctly via email. Under the subject line, signage for schools, usage of deadly force authorized. Not a conducive atmosphere for young minds entering into a realm of learning experience. No, Jim's absolutely right. It is not. Kate wants to know, do we have to talk about guns again? We know Insane Wayne is full of it. This is getting so tedious. Could we memorialize Larry King? There's so much more to talk about. And she adds, the other Larry King, the one who gave us the best little whorehouse in Texas, funny and talented Texas, not crazy and dangerous Texas. Yeah, I suppose we can talk about other things. I suppose we can. The question is, what else is there to talk about when we know that we're just around the corner from another one of these? Kind of sucks all the oxygen out of the room, doesn't it? But there are other stories out there. There are excellent stories out there. I got word last night of a magnificent book that I intend to read as soon as I can afford it. Clean Break, the story of Germany's energy transformation and what Americans can learn from it. Book of the year is what Jeff Biggers, our good friend, calls it over at Huffington Post. The Germans have come up with one of those handy compound nouns, Energiewende. It means power shift, and it describes their attempt to move away from filthy fossil fuel energy. And this book by Osha Gray Davidson, lays out, as Jeff Biggers describes it, this transition in Germany with the verve of a page-turning Bildungsroman, with all the facts and figures to lay out a roadmap for our nation's own transformation. Written with the skill and intrigue of an investigative journalist tracking down a mystery, Davidson takes us on a fact-finding journey to Germany's corridors of power, from politics to the prairies to the Black Forest, to understand how Europe's most important industrial power has managed to meet such an ambitious plan for renewable energy production. Wow. I'm going to try to read it, and I'm going to try to get the author on this program. Ray writing in. He says the NRA... talking about our gun problem is like asking two chickens and a wolf to take a vote on what's for dinner. He adds, if we're going to arm teachers, the teachers will have to be equally armed as the attacker. That's an interesting thought. Grenade launchers all the way around. Yeah. You know, the other night, last night, talked a little bit about the history of the NRA. You know, in the earliest days of their founding, they created a shooting range and shooting club. It's out somewhere on Long Island, I think. But they were chased out of New York by people who knew even in 1871 that they were toxic. As pointed out, it was founded with former Union General Burnside as one of the officers. And it was founded out of the concern that so many Union soldiers had proven to be such poor shots as compared to the Bubbas in Butternut, who had been shooting all their lives just to survive because all of the wealth was concentrated in the hands of old Massa down at the plantation. So poor Southern whites subsisted on, you know, squirrel gravy, which is actually delicious. But then again, and this is the food porn part of the program, the great part of genius in culinary skill is making otherwise inedible things downright enviable. Yeah. And so it was formed almost contemporaneously with the Klan. How do you like that? No, we don't have to necessarily talk about the NRA and Crazy Wayne. But it's interesting that the topic of the Civil War came up in conversation, I believe, with Jim last night. And I just raised it again. And of course, the South refights it constantly. Well, there's a guy, a right winger, over at Wingnut Daily, regular guest on Fox, by the name of Eric Rush. And he sent this out to the weirdos who follow him.
Hey everybody, I'm Christopher Green. You're watching Greenwave TV, alternative media television. Please get this article out to as many people as possible. I'm broadcasting very early in the AM, Monday, December 17, 2012. This is a significant update to the killing spree that just occurred with Adam Lanza. This is from Mail Online. It says, did paranoid, gun-crazed mother trigger son's school killing spree? Friends say she believed the world was on edge of collapse. Nancy Lanza portrayed as a survivalist, a prepper, who stockpiled food, water, and guns. She was, of course, brutally shot 4 times by her son in the head, possibly as she slept. Her collection of guns included handguns, assault rifle, and 2 hunting rifles. They describe her son Adam as reclusive, highly intelligent. Of course, he was on psychotropic medications.
Yeah, freak. Get on with it.
Which he was set to testify on, which he will no longer testify. I broke an article to you yesterday, last evening, that Hillary Clinton just conveniently suffered a concussion. She will not be testifying on Benghazi Gate. He's obviously just recently toppled Libya, murdered, assassinated Muammar Gaddafi. He's been running guns out of Libya into Syria. This is what killed CIA agent Christopher Stevens and 3 others. Now, she's not testifying. But in addition to that, what makes this even more scandalous and puts more motive on these MKUltra-style killings, and I personally haven't even come out and said that this was an MKUltra killing until now, but this is looking a lot more fishy. This is looking a lot more, the motive is becoming a lot more clear. Not only is Adam Lanza's, or was Adam Lanza's father, connected to the LIBOR ring, but so was James Holmes' father, Mr. Holmes. He was a very high-level, highly paid executive of FICO, the credit score, credit rating agency. So here we have 2 killers, 2 crazed, reclusive, highly intelligent.
You getting the gist of this?
Where when President Barack Obama does go after the guns, when he does declare that he's going to begin confiscating AK-47s, weapons of war, semi-automatic and automatic weapons. And when he creates a national registry and takes away sovereignty of gun rights here in America and puts it in the hands of an independent third party in the name of the United Nations, look this up for yourself. This is the UN disarmament.
It goes so well with black helicopters.
I want you to seriously take this as a declaration of war. Imagine yourself. Imagine what it was like for Thomas Jefferson, or what it was like for George Washington, or what it was like for these patriots. This is a declaration of war, and this will result in a new American Civil War. This is a very dangerous time in American history. And the fact that they're so clearly demonizing survivalists, demonizing preppers, demonizing those people that rightfully so see the writing on the wall.
Rightfully so. Enough of this, Goober. Did you hear that? Now, here we are, progressives, liberals, what have you, minding our own business, want no part of these freaks, and they're calling for civil war. Now, this Eric Rush doofus had written earlier that he hoped back in the heady days when the Repiglicans were just sure that America was going to choose Thurston Howell Romney the sixth or whatever the hell he was as the president of the United States. Eric Rush wrote that it was his hope that the Romney administration would imprison liberals and journalists. Yeah. We can talk about other things, but somehow it strikes me that when, just as in the late 1850s, certain right-wingers started talking about secession and civil war, some folks acted as though they weren't serious. Well, now it's happening again. And I'm not going to tell you to go in and lay in a bunch of water or guns. I'm not going to tell you anything. It's not my business. I think it's wise to have some dry beans and some rice and things like that laying around the house because, well, it has nothing to do with being prepped for doomsday. It has being and water. Good God, yes, water. It has to do with being prepared for every day because this is an immensely effed up country that can't even keep its own power on. Last night after the program, Ferg and I went down before the snow started flying. The wind was howling. But before the snow started flying, we went down and filled up our gas cans and came back and got busy trying to start the generator. Because after having had the derecho and then the Sandy blizzard within 4 months of each other, 4 months to the day, as a matter of fact, and having had a net power outage of something like 17 days out of the two, being ready and knowing that our infrastructure is literally a bunch of wires strung on toothpicks through the trees that are going to fall again. I mean, my God, just out the road here, there is still a tree laying on a tree, lots of trees, laying on power lines. The power has already blinked once. So, yeah, we can, and with that in mind, we fully expect with this, and you know, it's a winter wonderland out there right now. Cold enough to freeze well digger's ass. snow on the ground, a few inches. The wind still kicking along pretty nicely. And just hoping against hope that the power doesn't go out, because when we came back and checked the oil and did everything we needed to do to get the generator, and then we started trying to crank the generator, all we got was a big nasty backfire. And so I'm hoping that will be self-correct or correcting somehow or another at some point later in the process. So yeah, keep some storable food handy and some water. But not because Obama's gonna get your guns. This from Eric Rush's column. In Obama speak, we have to change simply means we must all be willing to pitch the Constitution, capitalism, notion. Is capitalism in the Constitution? Because I didn't think it was, and I've read it cover to cover several times. It's not that long a document. We have to be ready to pitch the willing to pitch the Constitution, capitalism, notions of liberty, and traditional values as Obama sees fit. In an effort to squeeze as much popular political capital from the Sandy Hook tragedy as possible, the administration sent an email late Monday directing supporters to the president's weekend speech online in which he promised to take action to prevent mass shootings. There were also donation link buttons on the page with the video and Obama's pledge, which gives rise to a visual of vultures picking flesh from the carcasses of dead first graders. Nice image, Eric! According to Eric Rush, we are being transformed. From citizens into subjects. Eric Rush was, however, as quiet as the tomb when a Republican Congress was busily passing the Patriot Act, when habeas corpus was taken out behind the building and bludgeoned, when domestic spying entered the national lexicon not as something illegal, but as something to expect on an everyday basis. They are aching for a civil war. Tim from L.A. with an interesting question. Aren't the shoot-em-up violent video games and movies inspirations from the real thing? I mean, wasn't it Fyodor Dostoevsky who said, at first art imitates life, then life will imitate art, then life will find its very existence from the arts? If Wayne LaPu and the NRA knew anything about history, then he and the NRA would then be guilty of all the murder and suicides, whether in real life or on the video games. This boy should keep his mouth shut, says Tim. Ron and Raleigh, as Granny Clampett used to say, do you like your possum falling off the bone tender or with a little fight left in him? Oh, God. Then, this from our dear friend Jude in the Northwest. The blatantly shocking timing of the NRA's propaganda statement today I found to bring more pain to this date, Bob, knowing it's just 1 week since the babies were killed along with the staff members. I'm finding a total lack of being able to express what I'm thinking. Used to be one who I think was somewhat articulate, but in these days I'm at a loss. Don't worry, Jude. Most of us are. It's not just you. And if there's any value in all of this, it is to point to the fact, in many ways, that it's not just us. Any one of us, but all of us. The feelings, on the other hand, Jude says, are flooding this vessel, along with so many others. So for me, it requires a constant evaluation to ensure that the negative does not take hold inside me. Love with intense focus. Embrace with arms of compassion and always be present to the moment at hand. Amen and amen. I, I don't mean for it to be this way, but dadgummit, just about every story in the stack. Well, no, not every story in the stack. We know, for instance, we know that John Boehner's pretty much done, right? As he announced that there would be no vote on Plan B or Plan 9 or whatever the hell it was, I couldn't help noticing Eric Leave Brittany Alone Cantor off to one side with what Shakespeare first identified many a year ago, many a century ago, as a lean and hungry look. I think the orange one knows that his race is run, his day is done, and set is his sun. Darlene pointing something out, very, very true. Thank you, Code Pink, for calling out the NRA during that press conference. They had plenty showtime of their protest banners. Brilliant work by Code Pink. If we really want to show America what we think of the NRA, we need a few thousand people to just create an what would we call it? Occupy the NRA. Just surround them peacefully, nonviolently, and let them know that we're not going to let them get away with facilitating the murder of any more of our babies. As that one piece of audio I played for you a little bit ago noted, and as I noted a couple of nights ago, every one of these I'm going to protect America from the government types has civil war and treason in his soul. And that's the next thing that we need to make clear, that the National Rifle Association is a treasonous organization. The National Rifle Association that has, of course, contributed thousands and thousands of dollars to people like John Boehner and people like Eric Cantor. David in South Carolina with a note, he says, let me just say this to the folks who are not alarmed. Many people willingly got on those trains. Some were even convinced they were going off on a wonderful vacation. They did not realize there were camps and dogs and experiments and gas and incinerators. Some didn't notice things slipping away, but others did notice, and they got out or tried to get out. Sometimes a little paranoia is just good common sense. Well, paranoia is defined as the irrational feeling, fear that other people are out to get you. When the right wing is telling you that they are aching for civil war in this country, it is no longer an irrational fear to think that they mean it. We can nip this in the bud, or we can let the National Rifle Association continue to feed these wild-eyed, treasonous urges. David in South Carolina also noting, you know, we've had a boner for way over 4 hours. Matter of fact, for over 4 years, and it's going to take more than an emergency room visit to repair the damage. Hopefully the damage is not permanent. Indeed. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, here's another story. Yeah, here's a story. Here's a not Sandy Hook story. It is the 21st of December. If we hadn't just spent the last 2 weeks wondering, sillily, preposterously if everything was going to come crashing down today, we probably could have had much more coverage of the war on Christmas. Also over at Wingnut Daily, there's a columnist by the name of Bert Prelutsky. He has found the source of the war on Christmas. David in South Carolina's noted a couple of minutes ago kind of reminded me of this. But Bert Prelutsky has found the source, the absolute wellspring of the war on Christmas. He writes, I lay a great deal of the blame at the feet of my fellow Jews. When it comes to pushing the multicultural anti-Christian agenda, you find Jewish judges, Jewish journalists, and the largely Jewish-funded ACLU at the forefront. What makes them even more obnoxious is that, by and large, Jews who are leading the crusade against... You know, you really shouldn't use Jews and crusade in the same sentence, Bert. Leading the crusade against what is, we should never forget, a national holiday are secular. So it's not even a question of their religion being shortchanged. They hate their own as well. They're the pinheads who pretend that separation of church and state appears in the Constitution. But the dirty little secret in America is that in spite of the occasional overpublicized rants by the likes of Mel Gibson and Michael Richards, anti-Semitism is no longer a problem in society. It's been replaced by a rampant anti-Christianity. For example, much of the hatred spewed toward George W. Bush had far less to do with his policies than with his religion. As you may have noticed, they haven't called Barack Obama any bad names, even though he's kept Gitmo open. Wow, Bert does not read the progressive blogosphere now, does he? Sociopath, psychopath, mass murderer, worse than Bush. Bush the darker. Yeah, Bert must have missed all of those, because all of those have come from not the right wing, but the so-called left. These Jewish bigots voiced no concern when Bill Clinton or John Kerry made a big production out of showing up at a black Baptist church or posing with Reverend Jesse Jackson, because, again, they understand that's just politics. They only object to politicians attending church for religious reasons. My fellow Jews, who often have the survival of Israel heading the list of their concerns when it comes to electing a president, only gave 26% of the vote to Bush and roughly 30% to Mitt Romney, even though... Wait, I thought this was about the war on Christmas. Oh, here it is. It is the ACLU, which is largely funded by Jews, that has a legal department that is almost exclusively Jewish, that is leading the attack against Christianity in America. It is they who have conned far too many people into believing that when the First Amendment states that Congress is prohibited from establishing a state religion, that what it really means is that a Christmas wreath can't be placed on City Hall. Oddly enough, Bert Prelutsky has apparently been hanging around with his Christian pals long enough to have caught the lying without blinking disease. There is no law that says a Christmas wreath cannot appear on City Hall. I am getting the idea that these self-righteous secular Jews won't be happy until they pull off their own version of the Spanish Inquisition. Really, you ought not use Jew and Spanish Inquisition in the same sentence, Bert. There's some history going on here. Forcing Christians to either deny their faith and convert to agnosticism or suffer the consequences. Speaking as a member, he concludes, of a minority group, and one of the smaller ones at that, I say it behooves those of us who don't accept Jesus Christ as our Savior to show some gratitude to those who do, and to start respecting the values and traditions of the overwhelming majority of our fellow citizens, just as we keep insisting that they respect ours. trying to suck up before the day of judgment when they run you through? Is that what you're doing, Bert? Or are you going to say, oh, yeah, okay, he got here. Turns out they weren't full of shit after all. All right, I confess Christ. Give me a sword. I'll let me get after some of my own. You believe this crap? It's, well, too much. Way too much. Or else not enough. There's never enough of this kind of hate to sate the appetites of the right wing, the blood-sodden right wing. The right wing who loves their goons more than they love our children, who are going to protect us from some dangerous freedom, hating, gun-grabbing, Kenyan Muslim socialist with a deep-seated hatred of white people. They're going to protect American freedom as long as they get to define the American freedoms they choose to protect. No, Cassie, he's really Jewish. He's just been hanging out with right-wing fundies. There's a, you know, I mean, that's a nice racket. It's kind of like being J.C. Watts in the Republican Party. If you're practically the only one of something, you will be paid well for being it. Dangerous business. Let us, like I said, phone lines are open. It is Friday on the front porch. 304-658-3333 is the number. We're just a few days away from Christmas. And it's way too cold out there for an earth-melting apocalypse, as far as I can tell. Isn't it weird we're getting winter weather and at Christmas and supposed to be, right, and, well, whatever. Jump in. Bob Kincaid Horn is the handle on Skype, and 304-658-3333 is the phone number. Let us go thus to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
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 Juanita?
Yes.
Hey, how are you?
I'm not so good.
No.
No?
Well,
before we go any further, you're going to have to turn down my voice back there because I'm coming back at me.
I'm off.
Okay.
I'm turned off. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I've got some sort of echo of me coming back, so you talk and I'll be quiet.
Well, I wrote you an email about this last week, but I think you were gone. And I was going to call in, but I have a serious problem with a gun situation.
I did see that.
You did?
Yes, I did.
Well, I've got stuff from Facebook now that verifies it.
Tell people what happened.
Well, what happened to begin with was. This was last Thursday morning, about 12:30 in the morning. She wrote, her and my friends are, her and my son are friends, we're friends.
Her who?
The one that I wrote you about, I didn't say.
Right, I don't know no names, but there's this woman.
Yeah.
Okay.
And my next door neighbor.
Okay.
And she does have a bad temper. But anyway, she wrote on Facebook about her son. Her youngest son came over and brought a coral snake he captured in the woods, and it had gotten out of his truck, and they were trying to find it. Well, they're very poisonous, you know, and they don't give you much time to do anything.
May I ask a quick question? Why did he feel the necessity to capture a coral snake?
I have no idea, but she even said on Facebook that he also had brought a rattlesnake out, you know. So I guess he just, I don't know. But anyway, Charles was furious about it. And I was upset. We were upset because of the macaques. And because I know, you know, they chew you. If they bite you, they chew you, and it goes direct. It doesn't hurt like a rattlesnake, but it goes direct to your lungs. And usually if you live, you're in a coma or whatever. You know, if they can hit some kind of a venom. But there's not a lot of venom because it's only about 100 bites a year, you know, or death or whatever. So I was concerned about that. So after a while, she didn't say anything. It was just like nothing. He thought there would be an upkeep, and I was thinking about calling a TV station and get somebody out here and see if they could pick them up. But anyway, my son made the mistake of writing her normal statement of saying that her son did a stupid thing. He didn't call him stupid. He's friends with him. They're friends. That was number one, and I told him that was his one mistake he made. And then the other was he said, I won't go to your place because I don't want to get, I forget exactly how he said it, but it could have been taken that he was threatening, but he knows out there she's married, you know. And, you know, but he didn't want, he was just trying to keep his anger in about it. As it was stupid. Well, I forget what else he said. I don't have that information, but I read it, and I told him, I said, you shouldn't have wrote the first part. And anyway, she went ballistic on Facebook. And she set him off. Well, he was trying to apologize, say, maybe we can talk things over and, you know, we're supposed to be friends and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I decided I'm not going to be afraid if a snake could be anywhere, it could come in my place, or it could, you know, go anywhere. And I kept telling Charles to ask her if they found a snake. Well, she had shut him off. So I said, I'm going out there. Went out there, and as soon as she saw me, she just came to the door just shaking with fury. Get out of my property. Get off my porch. How dare you, you know. And I said, all I want to know is what happened with the snake. And she goes on and she says, she doesn't really answer me. She says, well, you're out there looking for it, aren't you? I have this little light, you know, that you hang around your neck.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's dark. You know,
yeah, because
looking for a snake with that light.
Right, looking for a snake by the dark of the moon, and a very poisonous one at that.
Yeah,
that's a winning strategy.
And I said, I'm concerned because it's one of the most poisonous snakes there is. I mean, one of the most dangerous poisonous snakes. Oh, I thought it was a mamba.
Yeah, it's just a little snake.
How do you know it didn't go down the sidewalk down the other way from here?
I said, no, I don't know.
How do you know it's not?
The lot next door is not full of snakes. And I said, no, I don't know.
But anyway, to make a long story short, which first off, she told me I'd raised a piece of shit. And I started to say, but I was very calm about it, Bob, I just, because I couldn't retaliate it. I mean, I've got words in me, too, you know.
Right.
And he insulted my son. Insulted my son. And she
sure.
She said, he said you love him. And I said, no, he didn't. Yes, he did, you know, so I'm okay. Anyway,
I forget what all she did say, but he finally told me, he said, if he comes over here, I'll blow his brains all over into my porch. And we know she does have a gun. Well, today I got some of the things she wrote, and she,
one thing she said,
don't you ever threaten me with violence, because I have an F9mm waiting on you to come over here and get physical with me. I promise you, you won't swing but one F time. That's his few things. And,
dear God, Juanita.
And she was blaming my cats for scratching her car. She's been doing that for months, and I tell her to run off. She's been for a long time. And I just tell her, and you know, when I finally decided to leave, I said, look, as far as my cats go, I said, you've had them? Why, man, in months and months. Anyway, then I said, you fed them, and I said, and I told you and your husband to please run them off. But no, you fed them and all. Well, I won't be doing that anymore. I'll fix them, you know, so I don't know. But, anyway, I didn't know that she had wrote this on Facebook about the effing 9mm. But I think this might, I think what I'm going to do now, I didn't know what to do. I did call the animal control, and I actually talked to a police officer. He was answering their phone for some reason. He was deputy. We have a sheriff's department here. And he was real nice, and he said, well, you didn't report her for that. And I said, no, I don't want to do that now, because, see, I had a witness to her kind of adopted son was over there. Well, he's not going to say nothing against her, but because she does too much for him. And everything she said, that, you know, I could see him in the background. But anyway, I think now, see if you think this is a good idea. I'm going to document what happened to this my ability, and I'm going to print these out. And I don't know whether to go to the police. I do know one deputy that I might could go to if she's still there. She has, you know, gone elsewhere.
Well, Juanita is.
And I look at her say how furious. I mean, I've never. I mean, her whole being was just infuriated. Just it was just she was possessed. I mean, she was. I told Charlie, I said, she's crazy. She's absolutely crazy.
But you live in Florida.
Hell yeah, right. Right.
Juanita, hold on just a minute. I'm going to pot you down for a second so that I can talk without it echoing back at me. And I don't understand exactly what's going on with that. It's a technological problem. But anyway, let me suggest real quick that you're doing the right thing by documenting her conduct. But for heaven's sakes, stay as far away from this woman and her family as you possibly can. And that makes it especially difficult insofar as she's next door. Do not be afraid to talk to the police about this, because it's becoming so commonplace in Florida that they're beginning to expect it. I don't know if you were listening last night, but we had a story about one guy who shot another guy in Florida in line at Little Caesar's Pizza. Florida, probably more, well, Florida and Texas are neck and neck in this, of course, but both of them are far more of an armed madhouse than any other state in the union. Florida is a dangerous, dangerous place, and I'm not trying to increase your fears. You're a realistic person. Don't go anywhere near that woman's house. Don't let Charles go anywhere near that woman's house for any reason, because it's pretty obvious that they've gone round the bend. And you've got to do that in order to stay safe. Now I'm gonna bring this back up so you can talk again.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't think I really am expressing it how it was, and I completely detached myself. I was proud of myself because I didn't respond in kind. We'd probably have knocked out another problem being the loser, but I would have. But I'm glad I was acting saying about it, I guess. But, you know, when you say things about yourself... Oh, she says, well, Charles is going to die of popping pills and drinking. He's drunk every night. I said, no, he's not. It's not that he doesn't drink sometimes. He does. But... And he's a person who has allergies, and, you know, and when he was in school, you know, some of the teachers would ask him, was he on drugs? And he was, you know. And she says to me, he's drunk right now. And I said, no, yes, he is. You just don't know. You're an enabler. And she said a whole bunch of stuff in Facebook that I haven't read yet. But it's not good. But her husband told me one time, now I really like her husband. I know that he talks about her temper, and you can hear her, you know. So, anyway, like I said, pray for me or thank good for me or whatever you your way of doing. If anybody cares anything about me.
Absolutely.
Because of my son, you know, now he was questioning me, had she threatened me that way. She threatened me, but not to shoot me. But he said, well, that's all right. And I said, well, it's not all right with me that she threatened you. And I mean, tell me she's going to splatter his brains all over her porch if he dares to.
It's frightening. That's why I said what I said. Don't be afraid to document this.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to try to get it documented. And like I said, I just now, a while ago, Charles didn't know that they send the things over. Like emails on what the message is, it doesn't show what he said. But he apologized and sent a thing, because he didn't mean, because he likes the guy. He likes her son, he likes her. You know?
Yeah.
But I don't know if this is the way she talks to all of them. I know she's run a couple of her children off, because they can't take her. So I don't know if she, you know, when you tell somebody something, you say, no, it's this way. And it's completely what it's not, you know. And you do that enough time to children, it doesn't fare well, you know. But,
no.
I'm not over being upset about it. You know, if it was just involved me, but my son is disabled, he would have, if he hadn't gone on disability, he would have died. He was working in so many chemicals, working on where he had the produce, he had to be in one position. And I just told him one day, I said, less sick, we can't get you on disability.
And he and I lived on $650 a month. Naturally, I didn't have house payment then. I finally had my house. I haven't lived in a double wide mobile home. Of course, she's
sick of my looking at my place, you know.
Oh, dear.
All kind of stuff, you know. And the cats, she's talking about effing cats, you know. She claims she loves them, but...
She loves wait, let me get this straight. She loves the effing cats.
No, she don't love them. She loves the one before that.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Well, Juanita... do the best you can to have a peaceful and happy holiday season. You have the warmest regards and fondest hopes of the entire Horn family.
with you at all times. And, well, I'm hoping we'll be talking soon, and maybe the connection will be a little bit better next time.
Okay. I'm on one of those little bitty cell phones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that might be the problem. I don't know.
Okay. Well, you and Charles have a wonderful Christmas, and do take care, okay?
All righty.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. It's our good friend Juanita, and we will keep things rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Are you talking to me, sir?
I'm talking to you, Bill. What's going on?
Well, I just had to call everybody, and, you know, let's enjoy the real part of the season here, Bob. Let's light up these dark nights of the solstice, you know?
Indeed. And, oh, good line.
Yeah, that was part of it. That's part of what they was stolen from the Germanics. You know, the Yule and the English with the Yule log and the tree. And my grandmother had a couple of ornaments that clipped out of the tree, and they would hold a candle. But of course, I wasn't that insane, you know.
Oh, I heard those stories growing up too. My mother would tell me about how their Christmas tree had these little clips that she would put little candles in. And then wait for the house to burn down.
To burn down around you, yeah. I mean, I'm kind of cynical. I have one of my pet seasonal greetings is wishing everybody a very happy inventory clearance season. You know,
I don't think that's cynical, Bill. I think that's
realistic. Yeah, that's Christmas was. Well, I was raised in the RC Church, and luckily for us, we had guys you didn't have to run away from, you know. We were blessed with my dad had a buddy, he used to follow my dad's band around in the 30s and 40s, and my dad would play in Erie, and this guy would show up, he not wearing his collar backwards, wearing a business suit, and my dad told me meeting young women in the nightclubs, and hey, if you're going to do something, that beats the hell out of chasing kids, doesn't it?
It sure does. And, you know, basically just doing what priests have been doing for as long as there have been priests.
Yes, yes. Well, my great-grandfather was, according to my dad, I was told in the beginning that he was Eastern Orthodox and was allowed to get married. And then my dad's brother told me many years later that the old man was kidding me, that my great-grandfather was a Roman Catholic priest in a small PA mining town that was full of Austro-Hungarian immigrants. They were miners from the old country because, you know, the Carpathian Mountains there. What is it with mountains and coal, you know? It's like where there's one, you're going to find the other.
Well, but it also happens in flatland, too. What you actually have to have is... You need somewhere that used to be millions of years ago a swamp.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
And it
makes sense.
Right, and the dead vegetable matter falls over into the swamp, an airless environment, and proceeds to decay and compact, and the only thing that's left over is the carbon.
Ah.
That's a lot of, you know, when you think of... There are 100-foot-thick seams of coal out west. That's a lot of swamp.
Yep.
That's a lot. You know, that's a lot of 100-foot-tall ferns. You know what I mean?
Well, the first thing I remember hearing about coal when I was about 5, which would have been about 48, was the price of it. It was not going over big that year with people, and you know, and they say it was served a very useful purpose when people didn't really know exactly what an evil thing burning it was. It created heat, just as the Irishman, the peat bog, you know, digging up peat and burning it. But things go past usefulness, Bob. We've got to keep moving into other areas. It's like automobiles. If it hadn't been for Ford and the Mercedes bunch, you'd still be walking around behind a horse with a shovel. But now it's time to look for a new fuel for the internal combustion engine. or get rid of the infernal, as I used to refer to it, combustion engine and find a new power source. It's cleaner, and we're working on it with Mr. Tesla's. Tesla was something else. If you, I don't know how familiar you are with that guy.
Yeah.
But man, what a man.
Had an ugly anti-Semitic streak, but the rest of his brain was really good.
It seems to be that people go so far, and then something wrong has to creep in along the line. Well, Henry Ford, of course, was anti-Semitic as hell, no doubt about that. And but you and Jim hit something last night. I just finished a very good study of Gettysburg written by Noah Andre Trudeau. And you mentioned the breech-loading cannon. Yeah, Lee had two of them. They were English make Whitworths, and they shot it. They used a bolt for a solid shot, looked like a bolt rather than a ball, you know.
Wow, I didn't realize.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say I didn't realize the round was like that.
Mm-hmm.
Much more of the ballistic round that we would see
today. Yeah.
Right.
And what's with this Burnside? Where does Ambrose creep into this thing you were talking about?
Well, he was the founding officer of the National Rifle Association in 1871.
Okay, he had developed a breech loader, I believe, before the war, but he couldn't get the capital for it, and he never did. We talk about a piss poor general. That guy was
right. And what a magnificent choice to head up a right. Yeah.
Yeah. He Fredericksburg was his brainchild, and of course I have some pictures of the bridge down there at Antietam where he decided to make his men charge across a bridge. You know, in the face of heavy fire and big losses and. And he also, it was his corps that ran the mine, when they tried to mine under the Confederate lines, and then they
at Petersburg.
The whole thing. Yeah. And then they blew the mine was a beautiful piece of engineering. Because the Potomac Army commanders didn't think they could dig one that deep, long. But those PA miners did it. And then the guy who was the colonel of the regiment that dug the mine, after the war, he went to work for the company fighting against the Molly Maguires. If you're familiar with
them. Oh, more than, yes.
Yeah. They were basically early, well, unionists, you could call them, or there's another term that was used quite often. They were just men who were trying to get a decent day's work. Decent day's pay, you know. I grew up with a lot of admiration for the UMW of A, you know. Those of us who read over John L. Lewis and saw the movie Matewan, for instance. What do you think of that movie?
Oh, I love the movie. I mean, it takes some liberties with history, but what film doesn't?
Yeah.
But John Sayles is a brilliant filmmaker, and he did a brilliant job with the topic, and made the whole issue at least a little more a little more widely known.
Yeah, I brought it to the attention of the public of just how corrupt the mine owners were using their private detectives and any other bloodletter they could hire to do whatever they wanted. Well, Hammett, of course, Dashiell had been a Pinkerton detective, and he leaned pretty far left after he left the Pinks, you know. He saw things pretty differently after observing the Pinkerton agency's work out in the copper mines and that out west. Corrupting the, trying to break the unions, you know, which is still going on today, I guess. But I'll leave you with one story from this Trudeau novel. There was an Ohioan guess he was a musician, and he was a member of an Ohio regiment who went looking for a buddy of his on the evening of July 2nd, 1863. His buddy was missing. And that was a horrible day's fighting over there on the as far left of the Union lines. General Sickles, who was another character study in himself. But he brings his buddy back. They found him and brought him back. And his buddy had a very fitting, had a role in history coming up that nobody knew about at the time. The guy that was brought back and kept alive, his last name, Bob, was Nixon. He was great-grandfather to guess who?
Yeah, there's another something to put on the time machine list.
Oh, man. The ironies of history. Of course, Sickles, he was the first guy to plead temporary insanity in the States. He shot Philip Barton Key, who was the son of...
What, son or grandson of Francis Scott?
Scott Key, yes. And his defense lawyer, Sickles' defense lawyer, well, I guess Key had been messing with Sickles' wife. And, you know, that was my problem with the Ten Commandments, that coveting the wife used to be a real problem. It depended if she coveted me, too. Then we had problems, you know. What can I tell you? And if she was worth coveting, it was even more difficult. But, Sickles' defense attorney was a guy named Edwin M. Stanton.
There we go, Secretary of War.
Yeah, under Lincoln, yeah. And why did Lincoln have to get rid of Simon Cameron, his original Secretary of War? Because the guy was providing the Union Army with a bunch of crap. Uniforms that would fall apart in the rain. Because we all know that this military-industrial cheating and stealing, must be brand new, right? I can see one of Julius Caesar's centurions complaining, the damn wood they put on these spears, you lean on it and it breaks underneath you.
Actually, they were the Pilo were redesigned that way by Gaius Marius, but that's another story.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, you're an expert in that field. But again, best wishes to the family and enjoy the realities of the season. The beauty and the family.
Well, it is, like I said, colder than a well digger's ass. I imagine it's even colder up there by the lake where you are, Bill.
Yeah, we're getting snowed on pretty good tonight.
And we are as well, but it is pretty. The little mansion downtown that was built with the blood and sinew of coal miners by a coal baron is all prettied up with lights, and it's Victorian and stuff. And, it's just gorgeous. Just gorgeous.
Well, there's something about the lights, and some folks would say that it is a descendant of the Maccabees situation in the temple in Jerusalem, where the oil lasted longer than it was supposed to.
But if you think about the latitudes where the Germanic peoples are, you get the solstice is really, really important because it gets dark as hell up there.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
And so a cultural tradition of putting lights in the deepest darkness at this time of year makes extremely good sense. And as a matter of fact, our buddy Tim from L.A. wrote in a little bit ago on that quip from that Yahoo about, you can't put a Christmas wreath on City Hall.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know. Well, Bill, Tim wrote, Since when was a wreath a Christmas tree or its ornament Christian? They're pagan. You know, them devil worshippers. I mean, if a city wants to remove the tree or keep a wreath off its doors, Christians should celebrate. Them pagans are devil worshippers. These are the same people who said Christ was born on December 25th. Now, with the war going on for more than 10 years in Western Asia, there are no flocks of sheep roaming in the desert. It's snowing. Gullible.
Yep.
And these are the same people, Tim notes, that believed 9/11 was done by Muslims? Hmm? What? Hmm?
Don't even get me started on that one, Bob. I grew up full with a lot of right-wing family members complaining about FDR had planned Pearl Harbor and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, dear God.
Oh, yeah, and I'm slightly... I look askance at... 9/11, I would still wonder who told the Air Force to stand down that day and why, you know.
Yeah. Or
questions, you know.
I mean, I am firmly of the opinion that the Bush administration was utterly committed to making sure that something awful happened.
Yeah, it's possible.
So that they could go in and implement the plan for a new American project for a new American century. It's, you know, Paul Komlicher Wolfowitz, delivering the commencement address on June the 6th or 7th or something, 2001, in which he told the graduating cadet class of 2001, I can't tell you what's coming, but just be prepared to be surprised.
Yeah. And there's theories, Bob, that during the war years, the United States intelligence had war gamed the idea of a fleet coming out of the north that gets very little shipping after a certain time of the year. The Northern Pacific is not, a lot of ships quit running there after early November. So there's theories about so many things that sometimes you just have you scratching your head and hoping for the best, you know. But anyway, I hope the folks enjoy the holidays, and I'll talk to you afterward. You guys have a good, and as far as Ferg's guitar playing is getting better and better, huh?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I've got a sneaking suspicion y'all may get to hear some of it Christmas Eve.
Ah, good. Oh, you're running Christmas Eve?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I'll be here Monday night.
Well, good.
Shoot, man. The way things are looking, I may be here Tuesday night.
Yeah, you don't know what the way you're going to... Yeah, traveling this time of year when you're in certain climes to visit families, sometimes visiting my in-laws was bad enough without the bad weather, you know. It's a,
it's the truth.
Time they were okay, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, yeah, you take care, Bill, and we will talk soon. And, well, you know, like I said, we'll be here Monday night.
All right, sir. And how do I say happy... Happy holidays.
Yeah,
I hope O'Reilly heard that.
Yeah, exactly. And chokes on it. See you, Bill. Bye now.
Bye.
Happy holidays, O'Reilly. I hope you choke on it. Let's go back. Let's keep the conversation going. Cassie is with us via Skype. Hey, Cassie.
Hey, Bob.
How are you? Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Merry Seasonings.
Oh, I like that. Merry Seasonings, yes.
How's it going?
Good, I think. Well as can be expected. It's been a rough week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a rough holiday season, but you know, it's like Mark Twain said in The Diary of Adam and Eve, you know, Sunday pulled through.
Yeah.
We'll pull through.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to be back in Texas.
Oh, come on, from New Jersey? You're kidding.
Yeah.
Now,
you can't get tamales.
No, there are no tamales in Jersey. Oh, no, I'll bet. You know
Christmas
what? I'll bet
tamales,
there.
So
I'll bet there are some tamales in certain communities in Jersey.
What?
I'll bet there are tamales in certain communities in Jersey. You just got to find them.
But sometimes you just need to go home. So.
Absolutely. So now that you've been, you know, this is your third year of college. How much of your impressions of home changed when you do get to come back?
Well, it's way more spread out than I thought. Like, I didn't realize how spread out it was. I actually like the people better in Texas. A lot of them. Even though they're crazy.
That's because it's home, Cassie.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, well, this is friendlier. What else? I don't know. It's just home, I guess.
Was hearing your native dialect a little bit of a shock to the ear after several months of being, you know, up in New Jersey?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, you know, people talk right.
It's almost like music, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. when you have, you went to like Missouri, right?
Right.
So did people talk funny?
Yeah, oh yeah, especially the ones who had come down from places like Iowa.
Oh. Yeah, and, they just sound.
And Illinois, and yeah, I mean, that was my.
Wisconsin people. And
well, they were surprised, that, you know, in Missouri, for heaven's sakes, they were surprised that coming from Alabama, I was wearing shoes. In Missouri, even.
I get that, but I also get, like, how could I be smart and how could I talk the way I talk and have smart things come out of my mouth?
Well, that, you know, that's part of the that's part of the pleasant surprise that the horn is for people, even, Cassie, because the idea that there are progressives of Southern extraction and, you know, not wimpy milquetoast progressives, but really ferocious ones, comes as a shock to some folks.
Yeah. Well, we're past progressive, you and me.
Yeah. Oh,
we're liberal.
Yeah. We're unabashed. For I think my Facebook page describes me as ferociously liberal.
I like that. I like that. Anyway, so I came down. I'm helping Betsy for a few days, and I'm doing ornament night at the host family where I lived for my last 2 years of high school, my last year and a half, I guess. Of high school and ornament night and Christmas.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And yeah. And just taking a break.
How much of a break do you get before you have to head back?
I'm going back in 2 weeks.
Well, that's a little time. That's a little time to get your feet back on the ground or your boots.
Well, and then
that's another nice thing. You're back home. You can wear your boots, and nobody's going to look at you funny.
Well, I wear my boots everywhere, but
God, you can take the girl out of Texas, but you can't take the Texas out of the girl.
No.
I wear my boots everywhere.
I do. Not in the summer, but anyway. But I'm still giving myself a whole week to do exams and papers when I get back. Because, you know, we're on that stupid schedule.
You are. You're so responsible.
Well, you know, I look at it this way. I got here on a full scholarship. And I had this wonderful. What is that? What am I hearing?
I don't know. Are you still hearing it?
Yeah, I'm hearing your intro.
Okay.
I'm hearing something. Anyway, all right, I'll ignore it. So, like, I got into college. I got into, like, an amazing college on full scholarship. But in large part, I think, because in addition to my grades and my SATs and everything, I had a sob story. And I had, you know, and I had the possibility of all kinds of government, you know, it's full scholarship, but they're still taking the government money. They were very happy. It's full scholarship and they're taking all of the military stuff and everything else that I earned separately from that. But anyway, if I go to law school, when I go to law school, I'm not going to have any of that. Or I don't know what I'm going to have. Apparently it's much, much harder to get a scholarship.
Oh, it is. And you know what? I think that's by design to a certain extent, Cassie. Because you can't have young people going to law school and coming out unencumbered by debt. Because if they did that, they might do something silly and go out and work for the public good instead of desperately selling their services and their talents and their brains to silk-stocking law firms that, you know, defend polluters and rapers of the environment and poisoners of families and, you know, those kind of folks.
Right.
You know, that respectable lawyering.
Well, I have no intention of doing that kind. But so anyway, so I need to keep my grades really high. and I need to be in, you know, working and involved in all of the other stuff I'm involved in, so that when the time comes, I do qualify for another scholarship.
Well, absolutely. And well, have you begun to look at law schools?
Not really. I mean, just in the abstract.
Yale.
You know, Yale and I didn't get along when I went up there as a high school senior. But
Stanford.
You'd
like Stanford. You'd like Palo Alto.
Howdy.
I don't know where I want to end up. I'm a lot of the stuff that's out there about their reputations has a lot to do with how much money the graduates earn, and that is less important to me than what are they teaching and do they incorporate their values? Do they incorporate my values?
Right.
Incorporate, you know.
Well, the other thing, one of the other realities of private law schools, especially the silk stocking types, is that you've got massive grade inflation there. State law schools, you know, like state university law schools, they don't care. Sink or swim, and you're more likely to get a grade that is more reflective of your academic understanding of the topic. But it's not rewarded that way.
Well, I'm thinking, and I don't know if this is true, but I'm thinking that if I, you know, I'm looking to go into advocacy. I'm looking to work for either prison rights or children's rights or something that reflects what's important to me. And I'm thinking that those kinds of places will look more at my internship now and the kinds of things I do in the summer between law school more than they'll look at necessarily just pure grade point average. Once I get, you know, once I'm finishing law school.
Well, and the other thing is
five-year thing going, Bob. I'm like, I have this whole five-year plan of, anyway, so I'm like thinking out that far already, which is why I have to go up to New Jersey early and study for exams.
Understood. The other thing you might consider is looking, you know, keep an eye on members of Congress whom you actually respect. And think in terms out of law school of getting a staffer job there. Oh, by the way, Ray wrote in, can't wait for Cassie to get nominated to the Supreme Court. But your plan's still to be president, isn't it?
Yes,
okay.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Although I'm thinking, so 2032 may be premature. It looks like none of the major parties take you seriously until you're 40. This whole...
Well, you're age limited as far as the presidency is concerned.
Right, but I think that it has to be past that.
Well, you know, Barack Obama is 2 years older than I, or about a year and a half older than me. So, yeah, 50-ish, 48.
Okay. So I don't have to do it, you know, right after my birthday, but...
Yeah.
I mean, I tend to do that kind of thing.
That's okay. That's good.
I tend to, you know, I can do this at 18, okay, at 18 in the day I'm doing that. and I don't, you know, I don't have to do that with the press, but I am still running for president. It just may not be 2032.
Understood.
And that's okay. So anyway, you and I have exchanged a couple of emails in the last 2 days about Newtown, Connecticut.
Yes.
And have the kinds of things that I talked about the other kids in the school, is that something that anybody else has covered on your show? Because
no, not really. I think the degree of shock and horror at just simply what happened has pretty much absorbed everyone's attention. But you know, the angle that you took on it, I thought was profound.
Well, thank you. Okay, so here comes profound.
That now, you know what? I got to tell you before you get profound. You know what that sounded like? That sounded like Cassie after 3 years in Jersey.
Really?
Yeah. So here comes profound.
Okay. I can do a Jersey accent, but I'm not on the air. Anyway, so when I was a kid, school was the only safe place for me. And I thought my school, it never occurred to me that my teachers wouldn't protect us from anything in the world. And I had those doubts at home, but I never had those doubts at school. And I can't imagine being, forget being one of the first graders in the classroom, because that's completely beyond me to have to go back to school when you're the only kid in your class who survived. Like, I can't even, that's a Rick Goodner question, but, or maybe somebody way beyond him even. But can you imagine being like a third or fourth or fifth grader who didn't feel safe at home and who felt about school the way I always felt about school? And the teacher down the hall didn't protect her kids from being shot. And the principal tried to protect the whole school from being shot, and she got shot and killed. I can't imagine what that does to a kid. Kids' trust for any adults and their feelings about school. I mean, how are these kids ever going to go back to school?
And I when you wrote that, I have no idea. I don't know how you even begin to contemplate it.
I don't either.
And no amount of so-called grief counseling is going to make that first day okay. Now, I mean, for instance, every single child in that school is having to go back to school, but go to a different school, you know, until they get the blood off the walls and the bullet hole. I mean, there are certain parts of that school that are going to have to be utterly rebuilt.
So I think it's probably really good that they have each other and that they didn't put 20 in this school and 20 in that school and 30 over there. I think it's real good that they're keeping them together as a group. But I still think nothing's ever going to be the same.
No, never.
For the siblings, and even for the kids in other schools. I mean, if that happened to the school 6 miles from your house.
Well, there is not a parent in this country in the last week who has sent their children to school who has done so without a certain degree of dread and trepidation. And I think that there's a point to be made by our buddy David in South Carolina, who a few moments ago, Cassie, wrote, "All this push by the NRA and the GOP to put firearms into public schools is just one more step towards their ultimate goal of destroying and eliminating public schooling so they can privatize them and turn them over to some Blackwater-style company." And I think David has a point. I don't know how to put it, but, you know, I was talking over the course of the week about the fact that the right wing has no shame and has absolutely bootstrapped every piece of crap talking point that they've had in the last 10 years onto this story. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at one right now, Cassie, where the head of Tea Party Nation, Judson Phillips, says, mm-hmm. "If you want to pin blame on Sandy Hook, blame the teachers' unions." And that is so infuriating because those were, I mean...
No, they didn't say that.
I got it right here. "If you want to pin blame on Sandy Hook, blame the teachers' unions that have championed schools being gun-free zones. While the left is demonizing the NRA and moronic actors like Marg Helgenberger are calling for NRA members to be shot, the teachers' union is actually the focus of evil in the pre- and post-Sandy Hook world. The American Federation of Teachers is led by a nitwit named Randy Weingarten. After Sandy Hook, this brain donor opined the way to stop future mass killings at schools was to make them a complete and absolute gun-free zone. Though, Weingarten certainly proves that a high IQ is clearly an impediment to being the leader of the teachers' union. On and on and on it goes. After Sandy Hook, he concludes, one of the best things we can do is break the back of the teachers' union and break up the public school system. Now, that's one of the head teabaggers.
That's and beyond disgusting. That's just, I can't even...
Well, consider, from the other day, consider this conservative pundit, Charlotte Allen, who said, and this is a classic case of damning with faint praise, who said that Principal Hochsperger seemed to behave bravely. She was killed rushing the gunman, trying to do what Ms. Allen said she wanted done. She seemed...
do they want the principals to have automatic weapons with them while they're hugging the kindergarten kids as they come in the door?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's what Wayne LaPierre said today, is we've got to have more guns in schools.
I completely disagree. But anyway, I know that I wanted to talk about something else as well.
Sure.
Which is the whole mental illness thing. So, the same people, and it is exactly the same people, who want to blame every one of these massacres on one crazed lone gunman. Every single one of them will not fund mental health services in this country.
No, hell no. No, no.
And, you know, my mom is mentally ill. My brother has some things going on. I don't know what his diagnosis is, but he's definitely not 100% with us. Assuming that you and I are sane, but he's not 100% sane. And there is no help out there. Like, I was reading an article from, where is it from? ABC News, that says that just since 2009, the state general funding for mental health care has gone down by $4.35 billion. And that has closed over 3,000 beds and is in danger of closing another 1,249. And then this is the part where I think about my mom, who just... maybe there was healthcare out there 15, 10 years ago if she'd admitted the problems before she started getting arrested. Maybe there was some healthcare available. I have no idea. She wouldn't admit she had a problem. But there certainly isn't now. And right now in this nation, the largest mental health facilities are for inmates in the L.A. County Jail in California, the Cook County Jail in Illinois, and Rikers Island in New York. 56% of state prisoners and 45% of federal prisoners and 64% of jail inmates have been diagnosed with mental health problems. So, any treatment people can get, they can only get in jail. And we know how horrible that treatment is. That's not anything that's really solving the problem. And
those are brutal numbers, because these inmates did not become mentally ill because they went to jail. I would hazard a guess that they had these issues before they committed the offense that wound up getting them jailed. That, in fact, the mental illness probably contributed to why they did what they did.
Right. Well, I mean, I know, you know, my mom used all of her illegal drugs to try and calm what was going on in her brain.
Yeah, self-medication.
Right. And then, you know, she got herself behind in paying for it, and then she ended up selling them, and then, you know, I mean, one thing on top of another, but which is pretty common, actually. It's a pretty common way that people end up in jail for the long term. And she is now long term in jail, in prison. But why as a country, and I know you talk about the punishment fetish, but why as a country would we not treat mental illness as illness and properly treat it outside of jail so we don't have to treat it in jail?
Well, first of all, so many of our jails now are for-profit, Cassie.
Yes.
And every empty bed represents a diminution in shareholder dividend profits at the end of the quarter. So there is a free market motive to making sure that there's somebody in that bed. One.
Right. And we dealt with that the last time through with my mom.
Two, mental health has a profound stigma attached to it.
That's what kept her from getting help.
I mean, when you think about the fact that the first man nominated as his running mate by Senator McGovern was driven from the race when it was found out that he had been treated for depression. And this is 1972.
Everybody has been treated for depression.
Depression is, in some senses, a part of being human. It's when it gets to the point where you can't function around it that it has, you know, that it has, for lack of a better term, metastasized into something that has to be worked on. But we have a culture look at one of the things that has been mentioned as part of the problem from Sandy Hook is that, well, we've got to deal with all of these pharmaceutical medications. And there's an element of truth to that. There, you know, look at the number of kids, young people your age, Cassie, and people who are younger, teenagers, who are routinely put on medications that there's not even sufficient research to suggest whether or not it's even safe. But at the same time, when we start looking at the mentally ill, and I think this was sort of your thesis at the beginning, instead of looking at the root cause of the problem, all we do is guarantee that we're going to have more of the problem.
Yeah, So let's say the only way to treat mental illness is by sending people to for-profit jails. So then that comes back to my sacrilegious question to you. In my second email, my third email, which is, instead of emptying all of the hospitals, would it have been better if Ronald Reagan had just privatized them all? Like, if we were just, I mean, because the for-profit system, to some degree, does take care of some things in a way that the for-profit hospital system is not taking care of mental illness.
Well, howdy!
Hey, Cassie, real quick, could you mute the speaker on your chat room there, please?
Yes.
Okay.
Hold on. There it is.
Yeah. Little red X. Isn't that what ultimately happened? HCA taken over hospitals that used to be they're still technically not for profit, but organizations like HCA are massive profit generating centers.
So why are they closing the mental health beds? Are they just not as profitable?
there's not as much coverage. For instance, if you have for-profit healthcare coverage, it might have a week, 2 weeks, at maximum 6 weeks coverage for inpatient mental health care. Well, that's not going to get the job done if you are an addict. Or, you've got to be able to pay out of pocket. Rush Limbaugh was gone from the microphone for 6 weeks out there petting horses in Arizona. And he was able to be there because he could pay with his own money. Well, there just aren't a lot of people who can pay with their own money for for long-term mental health care.
Especially not if they lost their jobs because they were mentally, doing crazy stuff at work.
Yeah. Even within the public legal system, trying to get and I know this from firsthand experience, not inside my family, but from things that I've done with my life, past occupations and whatnot. If you've got someone who is badly mentally ill, uninsured, and you go through the mental hygiene, in West Virginia it's called the mental hygiene process. Now, if the mental hygiene commissioner issues a pickup order, well, there has to be a mental hygiene hearing, the statute says forthwith, which means within 24 hours. But after that, the real circus begins, because if you've got a person who is danger, and the standard there is whether the person is a danger to himself or others.
Right, that's my next question.
Even if the finding is a bright line clear on that, then you've got these social service professionals who are absolutely beside themselves, calling all over the state of West Virginia, calling into Virginia, calling into Kentucky, calling into Ohio, calling into Pennsylvania, as far away as Tennessee, trying to find a bed for an indigent or an uninsured individual. And then the state has to pay for that, because the state has taken on the task of commitment. But even if the commitment goes through, the most they're going to be there is usually 6 days. Because, among other things, those are federal monies that have been passed down to the states for purposes of, things like Medicaid. And the money simply is not there. I mean, we have gotten ourselves
into... And nobody gets cured in 6 days.
No. In the case of someone with a terrible addiction problem, they don't even begin to get sober in 6 days.
Yeah, we've been down that road, too. Okay, so here's the question about being a present danger. After the 6 days, they're not a danger, right? Because they release them.
That's not as clear.
Right, but to the law. Legally, they're not a danger anymore.
Well, that has to be a finding made either by some commissioner or judge.
All right, so in West Virginia, before the commissioner makes his finding, can the person buy a gun?
Theoretically, no.
But if they go to a gun show, they can.
If you go to a gun show, if you go to a gun show with the floppy shoes and the fright wig and the red nose and the clown suit on, if the money comes out of your wallet, you can get a gun.
That's kind of a big problem, Bob.
It's a giant problem. I mean, like Carol calling in from Vegas last night pointed out, there's a couple of those a month in Vegas. Hell, there's one going on at any given time on any weekend in the state of West Virginia, probably Alabama, Georgia, and the rest of the Confederacy. And we're talking about local civic centers, armories, things like, you know, big convention spaces being rented out for these things. And every table is always filled. And it is every kind of weapon under the sun.
All right, so let me... Now,
and the only limitation on your purchasing of power is the limitation imposed by your own wallet. And most of the transactions are cash, and they are utterly untraceable.
So, when my brother was my guardian, we had, at different times, when I was 11 and 12, and then again when I was 15, we had a county social worker who came to our house one time a month to check whether there was food in the refrigerator, whether I had my own bed, whether I had clothes, and to check how many guns were in the house. And we lied about the guns, but there was somebody asking. And it amazes me how that doesn't happen in other places. Like, that was because the part of Texas we were in was Austin.
Right, which theoretically is a little bastion of sane liberalism.
Well, that's also the reason why I had mental health services my entire teenage years. I mean, from the time I was 11, once my mom went to jail, I had all kinds of free mental health services until I left.
Right.
And that's because I lived in the civilized county.
And yet, you know, consider what then it must be like in a place like Alabama or Mississippi.
Well, that's what I'm thinking.
And then, then there's the story from a couple of years ago out of Florida, and I remember covering it on the show, when the NRA, of course, had a hissy, and all the, you know, the preppers and whatever were screaming about black helicopters and blue UN helmets and losing our freedom, you know, that kind of stuff, merely because the American Academy of Pediatrics had suggested a standard by which pediatricians, as part of the standard of care, and standard of care is, of course, a term of art within the law as well as within the practice of medicine, the standard of care that children should be asked if there are, and parents should be asked if there are any guns in the home, because guns in the home are a statistically viable, incredibly accurate predictor of future problems for that child. Okay?
It has to do with predicting
outcomes from a public health standpoint. Well, when Florida heard about that, Cassie, the Florida legislature, Republican controlled, of course, had a purple polka dotted blue screaming hissy and declared that it would be a violation of Florida law for any doctor to ask anybody about anybody's guns.
It was when I heard that I found out that it wasn't just standard practice, because I was used to it. I was used to the social workers. I mean, that was just one of the questions. You know, what did you have for dinner last night? And how often do you go to the store? And, you know, there was just...
Based on what you said a few minutes ago, though, you had also been trained to not tell the truth about the guns.
Well, see, now that's another problem. And look at what the outcomes were a year or two later. So, honestly... Yeah. The fact that, this is going to sound horrible, I can't believe I'm saying this, the fact that my sister-in-law and I were never hurt harder than we were hurt is kind of a miracle based on where my brother was in his mental state those last that last year that I was living at home.
It is not, Cassie, it is not a merely a figure of speech to say you dodged a bullet. And that's hard to get your head around. But you know, I mean, the wonderful thing about you is that over the years you have always been, as far as I can recall, you have been very, very alert and aware of the fact that you had some really, really concerned, good, decent people looking out for you. You know, I'm not going to talk about angels. I'm not going to talk about angels. I'm going to talk about really good human beings.
Yes, I had a lot of really amazing, including you. I had a lot of amazing people checking up on me and caring about me and wanting the best for me and helping me get help when I needed help.
And so what it sounds to me like, that has created a very positive sense of almost obligation in you to turn it back around and go and try to make somebody's life a little bit better. You know, I don't know if you heard Bill telling the story about the one guy who survived in the battle, and his last name was Nixon, and he was the great grandpappy of Richard Nixon. But those things happen in life. And any attempt to do right by someone, you never know the amount of good you can do. The Nixon thing is not a good example of that. That's just irony. But you know, you're determined, and I've never heard any lessening of that determination on your part.
Bob, I am a survivor, and I am going to make something. I'm going to make something out of all of this, some of this. I don't know. I am a survivor, and you're right. I am planning to give it all back. I'm not sure who I'm giving it back to. I'm not sure how.
That's not part of the program either. You don't get to know that determination. Even to the extent that you've set up this incredibly well thought out long term plan for yourself, may not work out that way. You know, it may turn out, and I'm just using this as a for instance because it's something that is close to me. It may turn out that you figure out you can do more good for children by trying to by working for a nonprofit that advocates that children have clean drinking water, because you know we can put up with a lot as humans, but we can't live without water,
right?
Or that the air be clean, because we can live for 30 or 40 or 60 days without food. We can go for 3 days without water, but we can't go 3 minutes without air. So all you can do is be open to the journey.
I completely am. I don't doubt it.
And you know, you're getting so many little notes here from your brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins in the Horn family. Tim from L.A. said, "We are so darn proud of Cassie. Please tell her that I'm in debt up to the yazoo in college debt after going for my bachelor's and master's. But after hearing Cassie was going to law school, I said, F it. I got to study for the LSATs. If I go into debt, I'll go into debt, because if our Cassie can do it, why can't I?" Imagine that, Dr. Cassie. And, you know, people like Ray talking about, what you've done, and the amount of concern and respect that you have generated over the years for your dogged determination.
And I mean, I just call and have the same conversations with you that I have off air, on air.
Yeah, true. I mean, Jim just wrote in and said, you know, best wishes to Cassie, overcoming extreme hardship and on to her career. Jim says, be well and prosper in your efforts to help others. And yet we put that up against, side by side, with the notion that trying to help others is somehow a bad thing that is espoused by these Ayn Rand acolyte-type Republican, you know, anarchists, whatever they are. You know, I'll take your end of that spectrum any day of the week, Cassie.
So I met a college kid here in Austin the other night and had dinner. And she seemed confused and surprised. So she's somebody else who's in Betsy's life. And she was confused and surprised that I would come into town 2 days early so that I could help Betsy when she was going to the hospital. And I was confused and dismayed that she wouldn't, when Betsy has helped her in some of the same ways she's helped me. And it's like, and I didn't say, well, I wouldn't have to if you would step up to the plate. But
that's not won't. Why you did it in the first place.
I did it because
it was done for you.
Take care of people. Because that's what we do with people we love.
It's as simple as that, isn't it?
That's, you know, we take care of the people we love. And so what, like, why wouldn't I, like, it's not like it cost me more on a plane ticket. It actually cost me less to come in on Wednesday before Christmas than it would have cost me if I'd waited. But, you know, ornament night is the same thing. It's like, that's a foster family that does so much good for so many girls.
And I was
going
to ask you, are they still doing it?
Ornament night?
No. Are they still taking in the at-risk children?
Yeah, beds, Bob. They got a kid in every bed. They don't even have the couch. That's why I have to stay at Betsy's.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's a 5-bedroom house, and there's 2 beds in every room. And 3 beds in one of the rooms.
And holy cow.
And they just, they have, every time you turn around, they've got more girls there. And all they do is love. Like, that's... And there's a whole bunch of us who have sort of graduated from being there.
Generally good outcomes?
Well, the ones who come back for Christmas, yes. I don't think everybody. And then there's some who I've lost track of and I'm not allowed to ask. Or I ask, but I don't get any answers. There's the little girl who I shared a room with. I can't get any answers about where she is.
Oh, God.
But other kids who lived there.
Wow. Well, this has been it's been kind of a heavy conversation. They have a way of being that way, Cassie. But for heaven's sakes, enjoy the 2 weeks that you've got there.
It
Take
started
a breather.
With that accent.
Well, it did. And
what the town looks like.
But that's, you know, that's good because, I think, well, it sharpens your observational skills to do things like that. But for heaven's sakes, enjoy the 2 weeks you've got home. Enjoy. I don't know how was it. Is it cool or cold? It's warm there, right? What, 70s?
No, it was. So last night it got below freezing for the first time. I brought it with me. I know I'm horrible. It got below freezing last night, and it's going to get below freezing again tonight. but there's no, they need precipitation. They don't need cold.
But it's a dry cold, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's really dry. I keep putting on chapstick. I'm like, and I'm sneezing. I don't know. I think I caught something on the airplane.
You know, you might be surprised to find out that when you change environments like that, sometimes it's not something on the airplane. Sometimes it's just the change in the air itself between one place and another.
Well, I've muted my mic a couple times to cough.
Hmm. Okay. Well, so you're going to see friends and go out and do stuff.
Yeah.
And
so I've already been.
I hear you did the Trail of Lights the other night.
Oh yeah, I did. That was Wednesday night when I came. And this is the first year. So the Trail of Lights was closed for 3 years because the city didn't have the funding to do it. So now it's been privatized, which they don't call it privatized. They call it that it's being, you know, funded by outside groups. So now there's an ad, like every five displays, there's an ad. It's not what it used to be.
Ads. Well, gotta make a buck, right?
Right, because the city doesn't have enough money to put on the trail, and people objected that that's how the city was spending its money.
There's nothing like a big sign next to Rudolph that says, well, you know, this display brought to you courtesy of Fred's funeral home.
Exactly. That's exactly. I should send you pictures. That's exactly.
Oh, Lord. I just hope there weren't any gun shop ads. But I wouldn't be surprised if there were some. Well, Cassie, have a wonderful holiday. Keep in touch. You know, don't forget we're out here because a lot of people like to know about your progress. Good luck with exams.
When I tune out, I tune out news and politics for like 3 weeks and just focus on school. Or if I focus on politics, it's politics related to my job.
But you're doing some writing and stuff, right?
Yeah, it's just not my personal blog. I've kind of let go. I'm doing a lot of writing. I'm doing it as part of the Woodrow Wilson School, Bob.
Whoa.
I mean, that's who ultimately my employer is the Woodrow Wilson School. That's the name on my checks. It's Princeton University Woodrow Wilson School. So, I am doing writing. None of it's going up on Cassia College. Honestly, I hope that nobody's paying the bills on that. I hope that was just a one time we bought this and not somebody's, you know, paying for it. Because I'm not using it, but.
Well, no worries. Well, have yourself a happy holiday and keep us posted, okay?
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays.
Can I say that? I'll say Merry Seasonings. That covers everybody.
I like that a lot. I really do.
All right.
Take care, Cassie. We love you.
Love you, too.
Via Skype, our very own Cassie. And we will let's keep this Friday on the front porch going. Back to the regular phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston, how are you?
All right. Merry Seasonings, I like that.
Yeah, isn't that great?
And what was the earlier one from Bill? Happy
happy inventory clearance season.
And also Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and Happy Solstice and a grieving solstice and grieving all of those things as well. You know, all this madness going on in the world.
Absolutely. It is fitting that you would be the one who would note that, Preston, because that is within the purview of your expertise. You are tapped in.
I actually just heard a lady call into Norman Goldman's show, and she gave a, you know, list of some of her concerns and her grief and depression and despair. And she even said she wasn't sure she wanted to stay in this world. And it was moving, and I so appreciated her honesty in saying publicly something that, you know, may have crossed the minds of a lot of us, and we're hesitant to talk about it because it's so, you know, it's upsetting. Still, the way she and Norm dialogued about it. It was moving, and I don't know.
I understand.
Yeah, and likewise, just, you know, these moments of getting to listen to someone like Cassie, and the things I've learned from your show as well, keeps me so inspired. I was moved to look up Molly Maguire's when Bill was talking about them.
Yeah, what a story that is.
Oh, my gosh. I'd known just a little bit about them, had some feel for it. There was that Sean Connery film, I think.
Right.
He was in a film, I think, called The
Heck of a, yeah, it's a heck of a movie.
You know, it's been years, and parts of it were probably going over my head a while back, but...
might be worth a rewatch.
Exactly. And, yeah, I was looking at their history on Wikipedia, and I noticed they were kind of... Well, it says, the Molly Maguires were accused of kidnapping and other crimes, largely because the allegations of one powerful industrialist, Franklin Goen, and the testimony of one Pinkerton detective. So, quite a story.
And, you know, there was a period of history where that was sort of the norm. If you think back to the execution of, the great labor balladeer who was framed on murder charges.
Joe Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
that was the opera. And, you know, to a certain extent, the same thing happened with Mate One. And what Bill mentioned about Dashiell Hammett, his was a real life. And, yeah, he was with the Pinkertons for a while, and that was a lot of the fodder that he used in writing, especially some of his early works. The ones featuring a character who was never given a real name but was merely referred to as the Continental Op. Red Harvest being one of them, and it's just a brutal book. He went pretty hard left when he left the Pinkertons. Bill's absolutely right.
You know, that's interesting that you mentioned that kind of transformation that can take place. You know, going from a Pinkerton to a labor guy, apparently.
Well, and just a general lefty.
Okay, excellent. Well, one of my Facebook friends, Colleen Rowley. Do you remember her? She's an FBI whistleblower.
Yeah, I was going to say, I recognize that name.
Yeah. You know, she's had quite a political evolution, and a friend of hers, Ray McGovern.
I've met Ray personally.
Oh, interesting.
Several years back, we broadcast a Seneca 2 forum in which he delivered a discussion, and he was simply amazing.
Excellent. They actually just aired a talk of his over Link TV, and there's a couple things I disagree with him on, but still a courageous guy, very thoughtful guy that I'm learning a lot from. And again, I appreciate people being open to transformation sometimes. And so I was thinking a lot also about what Cassie was saying about her mom. Again, I so appreciate people's honesty, radical honesty, and about her mom getting in trouble with the law, and she was selling illegal drugs, and there's that caricature of people who do that. It's such an unjust...
Oh, and it is a brutal, brutal caricature.
It's what was being done to the Molly Maguires, in a sense. You know, the allegations from powerful people and the testimonies of these sellout agents. Well, that's what, you know, go up against the pharmaceutical industry that wants to protect their market share. That's what this is about. This is a market war in so many ways. You can get put in a cage for selling cannabis or maybe some other traditional medicine like mushrooms or peyote, you end up in decades for that stuff.
Well, right. Meanwhile, and, you know, during the conversation, Ray pointed out when Cassie was asking the question about you know, why we run the mental health care system like we do,
mm-hmm.
Ray came up with a very blunt and very realistic answer, Preston. He said, we don't treat those people because we don't care. Disposable people.
Yeah, there's that going on. And then there's the way that treatment is being defined by some. It's getting very much, you know, treatment by pills is huge and growing. Options of talk therapy, well, that's not efficient. Takes too much time. Get them in, get them out, and make sure their lifetime.
Yeah, you know, get them on some sort of chemical restraint.
Yeah. Which sometimes the side effects, you know, I know people who have found some help with them. Other people, though, have had horrendous side effects with this stuff. They didn't know how addictive it was. They did not know that when they try to withdraw from this stuff, there would be something they call brain zaps. And I hear this over and over and over again. There are testimonies on YouTube of customers that are basically saying, people, be careful of this stuff. Know what you're getting into. Experiencing intense depression. And also, in the pharmaceutical industry admits that it produces for some people thoughts of
suicidal ideation
and homicide, and also mass destruction. That the most recent.
But Preston, can you understand my concerns at the way that violent video games, violent movies, the mentally ill, and psychotropic meds were trotted out in front of the very obvious firearm problem?
I do. Yeah, it's certainly being used as a deflection for some. So, you know, I think some people who are inclined to disagree with the NRA, I think when LaPierre was saying that stuff about the video games and the hyper-violent media we've got, is affecting their psyches. He didn't quite put it like
well,
that.
Well, the funny thing about the hyper-violent media part is that, I mean, the level of unself-awareness required to say that when part of that hyper-violent media is the media's tendency to over-report on these gun disasters.
There's that, you know, amusing ourselves.
I mean, look at, and there's no doubt that the reportage has a hand in some of this. I just had a note from Darlene up in Connecticut who called the program a few nights ago, and she said the shredding of that sense of safety continues. The new Milford, Connecticut school district closed all their schools today on the recommendation of the new Milford police due to several threats. Mm-hmm. 1 week to the day and hour of the Sandy Hook tragedy. This community is a few school districts away, well over 12 miles away from Newtown. She said, I have relatives attending New Milford schools. The threats were later found to be unsubstantiated, but still, how sick is that? So the torment of children and their parents continues.
Yeah.
And this plays into that larger query that I think both David in South Carolina and Cassie have opened in terms of, you know, what is the ultimate goal of all of this? What is the ultimate goal of an advocacy that all of our public schools be turned into an armed camp? That the first thing a child hoping to learn, you know, I'm a dad, Preston. I have seen, I've seen four children go off wide-eyed and excited to their first day of school. What happens to that wide-eyed excitement when the first thing you see is a guy armed to the teeth because we have a culture in this country that is tolerant of children being butchered in their schools?
Yeah, and they're going to be asked, you know, give us your ID or let us do our retina scan, and just a whole architecture of regimentation, control, surveillance. You know, the dogs, German Shepherds, being let through the school recently. I don't know if you noticed the Arizona raid, and that they're connected with the prison that will put them in a jail if they find some weed on them or whatever. But not, again, not Ritalin. They're taking that stuff hand over fist. That's being encouraged. That's being defined as mental health services and treatment. And it's, you know, big science. It's the most corrupt scientific field you can imagine. And, there's a guy named Peter Bregan, Dr. Peter Bregan. He was really a courageous leader in this field, and he's written several books, including Talking Back to Prozac, because kind of a play on listening to Prozac.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, the history of some of these drug companies, too, like Eli Lilly. You know, George Bush was on the board of directors of that one. And Mitch Daniels is another one. So know your dealers, at least.
Right.
And know.
Hey, kid, the first one's free.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. They offered my dad Paxil recently over his totally healthy depression over the loss of his wife. There's a book called The Disappearance of Sadness, how normal human emotions, the whole range, are healthy oftentimes. Certainly there are instances when they can be debilitating. And I think in a case like that, it doesn't have to be the pharmaceutical industry. There's these other traditions that go back millennia. You know, shamans, the traditional healers, we try to wipe these cultures out, but they still exist, and they're actually experiencing something of a resurgence, and I think it will be useful in some ways. It is being useful in some ways. So, what else? I don't know. Did you want to riff on that? Actually, let me mention one other.
Sure.
A resource. Back to the video and TV. And, you know, I watch a lot of violent stuff. I mean, more than I'd like to, actually, because of how the world can be sometimes, sad to say. But, you know, it's the way it's presented, I think, makes a huge difference. Is it like a...
Well, it's like the discussion that Dr. Allen engendered a few nights ago with one of his emails. You know, he said he finds the idea of violent movies and violent video games simply obscene. And I agree with that. But by the same token, I talked a little bit about the, you know, the ancient Greek concept of catharsis.
That
you couldn't get me into one of these modern horror movies for love nor money. A couple of weeks ago, Agnes and the kids went in to see that most recent vampire movie, and I said, well, I'll see you in a few minutes. I'm going to see Lincoln. I went to Lincoln because, I mean, it just holds no interest for me.
Mm-hmm. I used to watch those terrible slasher films when I was a young person.
Yeah.
And I watched them, or saw bits and pieces of them later, and I was like, this is horrible. This is so wrong on so many levels. And I think when I first watched it, some stuff was kind of flying over me. But I look at it now, and
what I'm getting at is, you know, these are generally aimed at a certain demographic.
Yeah.
And it ain't Roger Ebert. And I say that because I have so much profound respect for Mr. Ebert.
You know,
because it's a tacky horror movie,
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that it cannot serve that cathartic purpose. Because when everybody in the theater is saying, "No, dummy, don't go down into the basement,"
right?
You know,
right.
there's something happening in the way of a human response. Now, if there's one person in the theater who's saying, "Yeah, go down into the basement. I can't wait to see what happens to you," that person is disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, I am not utterly unaware of, you know, we can't even consider these questions, Preston, in some sort of academic rarefied atmosphere that discounts human nature.
Yeah, yeah. I did want to mention, and you may have seen his work, and there's a lot of debate as to whether is this stuff causal, is there causation, violent media leading to a violent way of being in the world, and it's hard to measure, but there's a book called Stop Teaching Our Kids to Kill by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, and he was a professor of psychology at West Point. And interestingly, he called this out. He was like, this is what we use to train people to kill in the military, and it's now spilling over to the civilian sector more intensely. And so, and again, I'm not for banning this stuff. It's like I won't be for banning cigarettes, but just growing awareness of it, you know, growing, you know, voices of criticism of it, I think, instead of just acceptance all the time. And I don't know.
But at no point in time when you were watching those films growing up, Preston, did you, I just know, I don't have to ask, at no point in time did you come away from that going, that looks like a good idea?
No, but, well, although if they frame it as you're always destroying pure evil and you're in this pure good position, and Rambo, you want to be like Rambo, or I don't know, you might even, if you don't want to do it physically, you can adopt the ideology of it all. There are all these narratives running within this stuff beyond going out on rampages, which does happen, and this stuff is directed to a lot of people in our military who are armed even more intensely than that shooter was. And there's lots of rampages going on. And they are fanatical over these action-adventure movies and the video games. I used to see a lot of it. I was involved in this group called Books for Soldiers. And you had the access to these soldiers, and they'd ask for material, and they were requesting Black Ops 2, and you know, some of this stuff was designed by with the Pentagon's assistance.
Sure, we had that story a few weeks ago about the Navy SEALs from SEAL Team 6 who recently got busted and got like pay withheld or something because they were actually selling military secrets to the video game company that makes the Medal of Honor series.
Okay.
They actually showed them the classified weapons, what would you call it? Not systems, but yeah, the weapons array that they use.
Okay. Yeah. In one of these games, one of the new ones, Oliver North, remember Colonel Oliver North, and he makes an appearance in this kind of pseudo-documentary that's embedded within the game. And they're reaching a massive audience. And, you know, some of it's going to sign up and be all gung-ho to shoot Muslims and stuff. And I reviewed Michael Moore's film, Bowling for Columbine, recently, parts of it. You know, it's only becoming more truthful, you know, more...
Yeah, well, Michael Moore himself said in a tweet late last week or early this week, I said all I have to say about this 10 years ago.
Yeah, right. Right, I saw that too.
And I, you know, I feel much the same. Every time one of these happens, and I don't want to be trite about this by any stretch of the imagination, Preston, but every time one of these things happens, my first inclination is to say, yeah, and? I mean, we know the cause. I think even the gun goobers really know the cause, because it is, you know, it's a case of that Shakespearean, methinks he doth protest too much. The degree to which they howl about, you know, my rights to own my gun so I can protect from the government.
Yeah.
Because they're either very Freudianly over protesting, or else they really do sit around with masturbatory Civil War treason fantasies.
Right, right. Right. And again, that narrative of you've got to be against the government that you should be participating in instead of just going after, you know, especially with these huge corporations wanting to move in on your country and take over more of it all the time. And there's a book called Gun Show Nation that really looks into the psychology and the politics of the gun culture community. You know, the industry has actually seen a decline in sales. They do a lot of hype about there are more permits asked for than ever before, but that's because they saw this loss in sales in individual customers, but they've been able to convince more of their customers to get multiple guns. So, I don't know. There are fewer hunters. They've lost some of the hunters, you know, and, you know, the part of the gun ownership that I could really have more respect for, people hunting their own meat and stuff.
Yeah, but Preston, we touched on that a little bit last night, or at least I tried to. There is no way that this country, in terms of territory, is already so far past carrying capacity that encouraging a movement of people to eat what they kill and kill what they eat would rapidly drive game species to extinction.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And even when we talk about legitimate hunters and the tradition of hunting, the tradition of hunting is in many places only less than 100 years old, because most of those species had to be reintroduced by, curiously enough, the government, you know, that government that never does anything right. Well, the only reason there are deer populations to hunt in places like West Virginia and Kentucky and so forth is because taxpayer dollars have been pumped relentlessly year after year into maintaining that herd. The only reason there is a trout to be caught in a single stream in this state is because thousands and millions of federal and state dollars go into the maintenance of fish hatcheries, where these fish are raised specifically for the purpose of letting guys with rod and reels go catch them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I think
and everyone can do it. But, you know, I think it could be a segment, you know, in some regions it might be appropriate for there still being the hunting and fishing traditions and maybe expanding them. But when I heard that they were losing some of their hunter gun sales, there are just fewer people doing it. What I thought of was, you know, places like the mountains you've been describing being demolished and the opportunities for people to hunt declining. Here in Colorado, you know, people get tired of tripping over all these gas pipelines and drills all over the place and the service roads and the toxic lakes all over. The land is just so under assault. Another rampage against life. And instead of a bushmaster, it was this industrial bushmaster, you know, against the land. And you may have seen, though, again, the people that, you know, make me want to stay here in this world as long as I can. People in Colorado blocking the fracking in Longmont, and they actually got props on, I think, either Common Dreams or Yes Magazine. So the battle is constant. You know, they're going to keep coming at it with their lawyers and their lobbyists, and our Governor Hickenlooper has he has connections with that industry. And I don't want to completely demonize the industry. In a sense, it's a testament to engineering ingenuity, for sure. And a lot of hard labor has gone into making that system of energy happen. But we can do so much better. And I don't know if you've seen...
Well, if we take for a moment the concept that the number of brilliant engineering designers is a finite number.
It is.
Then
maybe.
It's a finite number any way you slice it, but it's made more finite by the fact that we make it so damn difficult for anybody to go to college.
Yeah. Well, it's like what Eisenhower said about the military complex. It, you know, takes the minds of our scientists and engineers into, puts them into war making.
Right. So the point that I was going toward, Preston, is that to that extent, the more people who go in, I mean, the number, there was a survey not too long back, the single most profitable, best paying job in the world today is petroleum engineer.
Yeah. Yep. Bob, you would have been amazed. I was at a yoga class recently, and I had heard this guy speaking Spanish in the locker earlier, and I asked him, I was like, hey, man, are you from Mexico? And he's like, no, actually, I'm from Peru. And I was like, oh, cool. And we just got into this conversation, and I come to find out he's a consultant for the coal industry, and every month or so they fly him to Colombia.
Oh, what a brutal place that is. That is so odd you had mentioned that, though, Preston, because I was on a plane from Duluth to Minneapolis, sitting next to a guy who had an obvious Aussie accent, and struck up because, you know, I'm a plane nerd. I will talk to the guy next to me on the plane. Lo and behold, he was a consultant, and he's a project manager and has managed project for the coal industry and had managed mountaintop removal projects in West Virginia and Kentucky and Virginia and had managed taconite mine projects in northern Minnesota. You know, and there I was. I was coming away from, you know, my trip to Wisconsin, you know, and the struggle against a taconite mine in the Pinoki Hills.
Well, were you able to carry on the conversation with them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they didn't have to, drag our hands from around each other's throats. And,
excellent. Well, good.
But, you know, in a moment of candor, he said, I really don't know why they want to do what they're doing in Appalachia. He said, what we do, our mines in Australia are so far from where any human beings live that we literally helicopter people in to work every day. And you know, so well, the guy, you know, he was giving a little bit of ground.
That's interesting. That's exactly. He was giving a little bit of ground. And,
of course, that was ground that would be good for his business back home.
Right. I don't know if you've discussed.
But he said, for the, well, okay. For the life of me, I can't figure out why you want to blow up a mountain for a six inch thick seam of coal when we've got them back home. They're 100 feet thick, 30 meters. Mate, that's a lot of coal.
Interesting. I hope this person, you know, we just need some job retraining, right? And
well, and that was the larger question I was saying, or I was getting there, the larger point that I was getting to, Preston, and that is that there's a finite quantum of engineering brain power.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start reading this book about the German power shift that I mentioned at the beginning of the program. It was kindly given to me just a few minutes ago, and I really appreciate it.
Great.
And you know, if the number of minds that can be devoted to that kind of work is finite, then we need to create a system whereby some of that finite quantity of engineering genius can be devoted toward energies of the future, as Joe Manchin used to call them, you know, because they certainly can't be energies of the present, because the only energies of the present are coal, oil, and gas, and mostly coal.
But the more
petroleum engineers we put out there, is the less we have to talk about building grid, to work on building grid 2.0 and distributed grids, and things that can run on wind and solar that don't mean that children have to be born gasping for breath in Appalachia.
Right. And the same could be said about, you know, finite number of dollars to put into a good energy system. You know, some people are putting out floating the possible technological panacea of nuclear, but the uranium mining, the toxicity of that, the waste, the cost, the security state that you need around it, you know, to protect the uranium and guard the uranium and on, creating all sorts of messes and draining all that money away from the incredible solar, wind, geothermal, that rarely gets discussed. But ironically, George Bush's ranch house in Texas, that Crawford, that stage prop that they bought before his presidency, it apparently runs at least partially on geothermal, where they put these pipes down and they draw in the ambient temperature of the earth, and it can cool, and then it can heat in the winter and cool.
Right. Well, the college buildings there where I was in Ashland, Wisconsin, are geothermally heated. Hey, Preston, I do have to roll. I really appreciate it, but I've got one more on hold, and I want to make sure that I try to get to it. Let's do talk soon, and happy holidays and merry seasonings to you.
You bet. Bob, real quick, I want to clarify one thing. I just mentioned in passing something, a book title called Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Yes.
And I didn't want to leave it there because that's not what – it wasn't a point I was making. It was the title of a book.
Right.
But the point I wanted to make was that the book talks about how we hear these tragedies going on and we get so much news and the stories of cooperation and compassion and love, dare I say love, rarely get reported, but they're out there. And I hear it on your radio show, actually. So thanks for everything and to everybody in the Horn audience. Peace.
Thank you, Preston. Bye now. The Horn's resident optimist, that is Preston calling from Denver. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Wow, Gigi.
Yes.
You didn't think I'd remember? How could I forget? Got a couple of minutes here. I'm sorry I'm short getting to you.
Oh, that's quite all right. I was burning up with anger about the whole thing going on in Connecticut, but after listening to Cassie and Preston, I'm very calm now.
Oh, good.
But that doesn't take away how I feel about the situation.
No, not in the least.
I don't know if I can say exactly what's on my mind in 2 minutes, but I will say this. Speaking as a mom who lost a baby, under totally different circumstances than these parents, my heart really goes out to them, because even though right now they're surrounded by family and friends and well wishes from around the world, it goes away because people go back to their own lives. And I'm speaking from experience, then you really feel alone, and then all the emotions really start coming out. And I hope that there are people there for them,
yes,
to be with them. Sometimes the best thing you can do is just to sit there and listen. I think in my case, people were afraid to bring it up. They were afraid to say my daughter's name. She was born prematurely. She only lived 5 days.
Mm.
And, after a while, I was alone. My husband went back to work. And I tried to, get lost watching television, which was the worst thing you can do, because it seemed like every other commercial, every other show had a baby in it. And I watched television right now, especially during the holiday season, and you see nothing but children getting ready for Santa, playing games, whatever. It's being in family situations. And
it's crushing.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm.
So I hope they have someone there for them. You don't ever get over it. You just...
And I think that's what Cassie was thinking about. Just trying to think about the future of the survivors.
Yes.
And thank you so much, Gigi, for bringing up that reality. And I hope you have a good... And I know you've had a hard ride, hard road to hoe, as we say around here. But I hope you have a good and a peaceful and a decent holiday season. And thank you so much for staying on hold. And thank you so much for taking time to share that.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Bob. I hope you and your family have a wonderful holiday season.
Thank you, Gigi. Take care.
Okay. You
Bye-bye.
Too. Bye.
Gigi Mommy is her handle in the Malloy chat room. And what a wonderful soul. Thanks, everybody. I got to get out of here in a hurry. Happy weekend. We'll be here Christmas Eve. Bye now.